attitude. We are going to energize the country.
Stop Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Seamus, I'm not sure this is a great idea.
Order.
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Tom Blenkinsop, who is the former Labour Member of Parliament for Middlesbrough South. Welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Hi, Will.
So to begin with, I'd first of all like to ask, what was your reaction to the exit poll?
In many ways, having gone up for the week prior to the exit poll, was not a surprise, I'll be honest. I was mainly canvassing in places like Redcar, Darlington and Sedgefield. But as the weeks went on, I concentrated more on Sedgefield because it's quite apparent to me that the Teesside, Tees Valley, Machinot line that had existed prior had completely gone, and the Tories were now entering into the soft underbelly of long-term held Labour seats in Durham. So when I saw that result, I actually wasn't that surprised. In fact, I was more surprised in 2017 that I didn't see that exit poll then. It felt like 2017 deserves, if you know what I mean, and it's something I am. Labour MPs were still in Parliament between 2017 and 2019 had long expected it was going to be the case.
What do you think was the main reason behind the result? Do you think it was the leadership Brexit, a combination of the two, or what?
I think you've got to look at it in terms of a major and a minor. So in terms of the major influencer and the main issue that you'll get on any door, if you knocked on the door as a Labour canvasser, was Corbyn. That was the first thing that was raised, and it was the first thing on the minds of people who were traditionally Labour or were in like the undecided category that you'd usually try and contact us, bring over to, and coming as a former MP for a marginal seat, knowing how important that undecided voter category is, it was quite clear that they had all moved away from Labour. The secondary issue to get past the hurdle of Corbyn, which is very rare, was Brexit. Having said that, we were knocking all doors in certain parts, particularly in Sedgefield, where we started knocking people who weren't Labour before, because we were actually picking up people who were Liberal or Tory prior, who were very worried about the Johnson in relation to Brexit, are actually more pro-Remain. So there was actually a lot of churn going on in relation to Brexit-Remain. But to be brutally honest, you know, 9 out of 10 conversations began and ended on the issue of Corbyn. It was quite obvious. And I think it was quite obvious prior, because it was the same conversation that we had in 2017. But in 2017, people were prepared to hold their nose and vote because of the bad history of Corbyn hadn't been unpacked quite yet by the likes of the Daily Mail and the Express, but also the Conservative Party. The more in-depth knowledge that people got into Corbyn's history in relation to Hamas and Hezbollah and IRA and a whole host of a myriad of other issues just made it toxic for any canvasser on the doorstep.
I think that's something that a lot of people would agree with. Looking at the potential successors to Corbyn, what do you think of the leadership candidates as they stand? Is there a particular candidate that you think stands out as potential Labour leader material or potential prime ministerial material? What are your thoughts on the leadership candidates?
Three I would be happy with, and there's two I would have problems with for different reasons, and I'd probably sort of rank them in order of preference. So last, I think Rebecca Long-Bailey is a continuation of Corbynism. It's a continuation of the last 5 years, and if you take that to the electorate, you are undoubtedly going to get the same result. result all over again, if not worse. So I think most people understand that premise. You then have Emily Thornberry, who is able but has, you know, a bounce back and forth to commitments to certain issues, was very much involved in relation to Corbyn period. So therefore, I would probably say, to a lesser extent, but than Rebecca Long-Billy, but probably carries too much baggage. You then have Lisa Nandy, who I think is very able, very competent, but in terms of politics, he's probably more soft left to me, has a different opinion as to Brexit, the main issue during the general election, where I think real issue wasn't whether we were Brexit or Remain, although I'm pro-Remain, it's the fact that we were to Remain as seen as Brexit and Progressive be seen as Remain, so we annoyed everybody. And then we have Jess, who probably in terms of politics is closer to me, very, very able, much like Lisa, but I keep coming to the same conclusion in terms of how you have a bridge for all party members to assemble behind in order to bring the party together, but also to have someone who has the gravitas and ability seen by the average person on the street who isn't into politics and isn't a political geek like you or I. And that person I keep coming back to is Keir Starmer. And I think he has that ability and the potential to actually provide the opposition with leadership to hold the government to account, which we have sadly missed since the summer of 2015.
Regarding Keir Starmer, do you think that it is perhaps worrying that whilst he was in the shadow cabinet, he was perhaps not as vocal on the issue of anti-Semitism as he could have been? Or do you think that that was just something that went with being a part of the shadow cabinet? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's lots of different ways of looking at this, and there are lots of people moralising with each other on this issue. First and foremost, I think the best thing that Keir has done, as our other candidates, by the way, is to say that anti-Semitism is unacceptable, and those who've been guilty of it in all the different forms need to be dealt with, and in my view, expelled. Mm-hmm. Absolutely no hesitation. We don't even need to wait for the HRC report. It's quite crystal clear to people like me. In my position, I resigned as a whip as soon as Corbyn became leader, and I refused to be a candidate under his tenure as leader. So if you want to take a moral position, of which some of the people are accusing some of the leadership candidates of having, whether they were sitting MPs now or between 2017 and 2019, you know, people like me could shuck moralistic positions back at them because if you really want to be 100% moral on it, you shouldn't have stood at all while being leader, in my opinion, because I've made it very clear in previous articles and statements and in social media that I think Corbyn's tenure invited, encouraged that type of anti-Semitic behaviour to come on board because it came from fringe the left, which were never part of the Labour movement. Be that as it may, in terms of Keir, I think the proof will be in the pudding once he becomes leader. Because whilst Corbyn was leader with his entourage around him, it was almost impossible for anybody within the shadow cabinet to form a policy because as soon as he went through Lotto, it was blocked. And coming towards the end, and then Keir, as others will have known, that you know, in the last 6 months, especially when Corbyn was pressing for a general election, he was certain to lose. That it was about riding your time to make sure that he lost, was removed, and that they could then seize their opportunity in much the way that, much the same way, although not exactly the same way, mirroring 1993, taking over from Michael Crook. Sometimes you have to bide your time before you can remedy the situation. Not everyone can be a brave, heroic politician charging on a white steed, resigning left, right and centre. It depends on your own personal position and what you're prepared to put up with. I was different to others, but I wouldn't necessarily criticise where they came from. So I think the proof actually with Keir in terms of anti-Semitism will be how he deals with it if he wins. And I'm fairly confident that he'll be very robust at the issue. I think the country, media, and certainly wings of the sensible parts of the Labour Party will be wanting him to do so as well.
And you mentioned Corbyn's entourage there, and a lot of people who've been associated with Jeremy Corbyn, like Aaron Bastani, Ash Sarkar, Rachel Cousins, better known as Rachel Swindon, have perhaps not been as helpful to the Labour Party as they might think they are. What sort of role do you think that they will have in the future? Do you think that they will in any way still be associated with the leadership of the Labour Party, or do you think that they're going to fade in significance?
They should have no role at all. I mean, a lot of these people are basically grifters and carpetbaggers who've used the Corbyn period to elevate themselves to some self-appointed position, which they've neither been elected to nor warrant any academic credentials for being at. It's a new phenomenon where you have people in social media criticising the mainstream media but utterly desperate to appear upon it and coming out with, quite frankly, contradictory gibberish, changing the goalposts often when depending on what phone call they've had from James Milne or Carrie Murphy. So for me, they're the numbers, and rightly so. We want to get serious, we want proper people who people will respect. Most people on the street who aren't political, it's like to won't know who these people are, but the people who are on Twitter are well-meaning, but have been caught up in the whole Corbyn phenomenon. They've been grifted by these people, and they think these people have no affiliation, no history, and are aware of no history of the Labour Party, are somehow pillars of the Labour Party. They're nothing but they are literally sandcastles, which the waves of time will wash away very soon, and we can get back to normality.
Do you think that groups that, again, have been associated with Corbyn, like Momentum, should be removed from the Labour Party?
I don't know, I always had the Momentum, and I was well documented on saying all this in articles. Again, I wrote on the subject. It was a group which was set up by John Lansdowne and owned solely by John Lansdowne, basically for Jeremy Corbyn's leadership campaign. That then changed its name from Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, to Momentum overnight, and held all the data on individuals who were supporters or who were not. So in many, many, many ways, it was approaching, if not, although I can't necessarily say this is the case, but approaching or bordering upon the same tactics as Cambridge Analytica, using the same data methods, owned by one person, the sole shareholder, yet masquerading as a democratic organisation. And there's no greater example of how authoritarian that organisation is when it recently put out its ballot to its members, giving its members the choice of one candidate and one candidate only to back putting forward in the Labour leadership and Labour deputy leadership campaign. Had no prior history within the Labour Party, not affiliated to the Labour Party, and then somehow springs up in Labour Party GCs and conferences, cabling motions. It's a very worrying trend, and it reflects a period which we haven't seen since the 80s when militants were proscribed. It espouses a lot of similar views to militants in some cases, and behaves very much like militants, and my way should be described like militants.
Just going back to the election result for a moment, of course you didn't stand in this election or in 2017, but when you were a Member of Parliament, your seat was very much a rock-solid Labour seat, and it now has a Conservative MP, and it has since 2017. How do you feel about that?
I was involved, Middlesbrough South and Cream has been my CLP since I was 16. I still live in the constituency. I took over the Labour candidacy when Ashok, who I knew very well because I was his agent, died in the March of 2010. And at 29, I was selected. I mean, we had a long list of 200, we went down the short list, 12, and then I won the selection for my home area seat. And we held it in 2010. And bearing in mind, this was, I was in the same camp with Vera Byrne when she lost Redcar in 2010, and she had a 12,000 majority, and it went to a 5,000 Liberal majority in 2010, and I held to marginal seats. So historically, Middlesbrough South and East Cleveland, Stockton South, in the Teesside area, were two seats that the party owned both seats to form the government. And lo and behold, the Tories own both now. But between 2010 and 2019, either Labour or Tories held one or the other, which kept the other out of majority government. So watching my seat, which I held in 2010 against the odds, increased the majority in 2015, again against the odds, because we were losing seats in 2015, and then to see it lost in 2017, I wasn't surprised, but now to see it with an 11,500 Tory majority. Bearing in mind, 2 years ago, I bequeathed the party to Jeremy Corbyn, to Momentum locally, who had infected my COP and wanted rid of me. I bequeathed them a seat with a 2,000 plus majority. It's now an 11,500 Tory majority in 2 years.
What?
Give you some sort of. That's like.
Is it?
Like 18 years of Conservative government accelerated at such a rapid rate. It's like the 80s times, it's like the 80s in hyperdrive.
Yeah.
And that's not because the Tories have suddenly become electorally suitable. It's not whether they've become led by a dynamic, charismatic leader. I think Boris is charismatic, but I think his flaws are open and there for the taking.
Mm.
It is there. It is 11,500 majority because the hard left insisted it knew better. Irrespective of all historical knowledge, all the data, all the experiences prior where they have failed miserably, they've managed to fail so miserably this time that it's worse than even their most miserable failures. And they like to ring out figures about Corbyn's support majority in 2017, you know, total votes in 2017 and 2019. It's just sophistry. It is hokum. It is snake oil. If you have a seat which Labour only, I mean, the history of this seat in particular is Ashok, an Asian candidate who had the most racist campaign run against him by the Tories in 1991 in a by-election when Richard Holt stood against, when Richard Holt died, Ashok stood against Michael Bates. Ashok won that by-election in 1991. 6 months later, he lost it in 1992, only just to Michael Bates, and then took it back again in 1997. So this seat, as it existed, whether it was Landbar prior or the Minister of South and East Cleveland, was only gained under Kinnock and Blair. When the hard left ran the party, ran the show, and put on who they wanted, they have lost miserably. And they have no comeback. And what it exposed as well is that those seats like mine and Stockton South, which were like the marginal line, the red wall, the marginal red wall for Labour, which held back the Tories, if we fell, it could surge through the North. If we went, as did happen in 2017, and I weren't there to defend in 2019, the push for campaigning and seats in the red wall just wasn't adequate. And the Tories could run riot with it, solely on the national message. Because there's no machinery at a local level and Momentum pretending that their attempts at campaigning was just ridiculous. They have no idea what they're doing. And that institutional memory loss within the Labour Party of basically agents and candidates and councillors who knew how to run an operation, how to be Tories, who were driven out of the party or told not to turn up anymore or F off and join the Tories. Well, that's exactly what Momentum got. They basically told not just people who had won seats for Labour and campaigned for Labour, but they basically told the general public to F off and join the Tories. And guess what they did in their millions?
Looking at the current election result, what do you think of some of the members of Parliament who have been elected for the Labour Party, who are very much in the sort of the Corbyn camp, people like Sam Tarry, Zara Sultana? What do you think of them as members of Parliament, just on what you've seen so far?
I mean, it's very early days. People have probably only just made the speech. You know, Zara made hers, and I made a comment about her in the speech. I think if I was a Corbyn MP who wasn't in London, Bristol, or a major city in accommodation, I'd be worried, because looking at their seats, they lost majorities quite heavily. They were walking into seats in Coventry, which had several thousand in terms of majority, which now only has 400, I think there are some counties. If she persists with the same message, she won't be there very long. They'll be in for a very rude awakening. I just think there's a real naivety, a combination of an arrogance of naivety mixed with the arrogance of an ideological position, much the same way, which informs everything. And if you ignore all empirical evidence, which is telling you there's a problem, because you're just driven with an ideological view, and you're going to come a cropper. You really, really are. You've got to be fleet of foot as a politician and be able to react to things, but also use your judgment. Ultimately, people want MPs to go in there and use their judgment. You're paid a very good salary because of your judgment, not because of your adherence to a dogma. And if you have a situation where Rebecca Long-Bailey is the leader, that type of politics is allowed to continue, proliferate for the Labour Party, it could drive the Labour Party to get, in terms of parliamentary representation, not seen before, not seen since probably 1931.
Just going on to when you were a Member of Parliament, you were a member of the Environment Select Committee and then the Energy and Climate Change Committee. What are your thoughts about current climate change and environment policy? Do you think it goes far enough? Does it not go far enough? What are your thoughts on it?
Well, at the last Labour Party conference, myself and Ed Miliband had a debate on this issue for Labour students in relation to our take on policy. What tends to happen in climate change debate is that legislation is proposed, or mechanisms proposed for legislative reasons, which are then put down and then seen as levers, which suddenly have magical powers to be applied to the economy and change things radically and quickly. There are all sorts of unforeseen consequences in terms of trying to say, get to zero net carbon by 2030 or 2040, especially in terms of manufacturing, especially in terms of how you keep a northern European country warm, all sorts of ramifications, and the pursuit technologically of everything going down the electric route in terms of the need to have a generation of electricity in house distributed. Again, it's highly expensive, but also fairly carbon intensive in and of itself, in terms of how much infrastructure you'd have to construct to take, the transport network from what is essentially fossil fuel to electric. You'd have to assess how you're generating that capacity of electricity when we're moving away from large scale power plants. I don't think anyone really has done the technical work that it requires. They come out with the numbers and the legislation, but they're not looking at the background technical work which is required, nor the budgetary capacity, nor the timeline or time frame in terms of how you're going to lay that out. And even if you did that, you then still have to work out how you're going to get the skills to deliver that in a situation where we're also leaving the European Union. And the amount of skilled labour within the UK economy is going to reduce rapidly, or the flexibility of it is going to be curtailed quite significantly. And we're not investing in the skills required to deliver that type of capacity issue. So I just think there's a lot of amateurism. There's no real profound hard work that, say, went into the creation of the National Grid or other such programs, and there isn't the experience. Furthermore, I also think, given the nature of the civil service, where you have a constant turnover of staff within departments, coming from mainly non-scientific degrees from Oxbridge, isn't necessarily the background of a body of people that you want to draw on if you're suddenly going to go into this very techie, technocratic
Yeah. Regarding the civil service, what do you think of Dominic Cummings' blog post that he wrote a couple of weeks back, in which he said that he wanted people joining the team within 10 Downing Street to be misfits and weirdos and not to necessarily come from an Oxbridge background? Do you think that he might be able to change the way that government works and to shake up the civil service, or do you think that what he's just saying is just hollow words?
I have some sympathy with part of what in terms of opening up the civil service, but he also remarked about how they were going to be treated, some of the criteria by which they'd be treated wouldn't meet employment law. There's ways of doing things. I think the fact that he himself is a weirdo doesn't necessarily lend itself to getting people in that might actually have practical solutions. And in terms of opening up the Whitehall to technocratic solutions, that has always been an issue, especially coming from my background in terms of the former APPG chair on Steele, trying to pin civil servants down to get a consistency of approach to the issue was quite difficult. After we got there more recently, but it was a bane of our land. You deal with one civil servant, and then 2 years later, they'd be moved to another department. And you have to start right from the very beginning to explain the situation rather than people coming turning up to the job with the same prevailing narratives, which is that the Steel Industry basket case. He's trying to explain to people or re-explain to people from the beginning how we got to where we are now and what we need to do to move on. And that was highly frustrating to a certain extent. So what would probably be better is more technocratic skills, also more stability in positions where people can stay longer and gain a greater depth of expertise in a department, perhaps. But I know the civil service has its own ways, and that you can't stop people from moving on to other, you know, career progression in other departments. But it is highly frustrating.
Just moving back to the Labour Party for a moment, there's been a certain amount of dismay at Paul Mason, who has made certain remarks about abortion law in relation to Rebecca Long Bailey, and remark that seemed to be anti-Catholic in its nature. Do you think that this is something that is going to be a problem throughout the leadership campaign, people making remarks and comments that are perhaps not fully all right or negative in their nature?
Look, I mean, I'm Roman Catholic, but I believe in the right of woman to choose. I brought it as such in Parliament when required to. In terms of Rebecca Long Bailey, the point is the scrutiny is going to be poured onto candidates on every issue. If you're proposing to be the leader of the Labour Party, and therefore also proposing to be Prime Minister of the country, you're going to get scrutinised nth degree. So those individuals need to get used to that now, because it's just going to continue and it isn't going to go away. But that's been used by Paul Mason, and I don't know what he said, but he's used that to attack her or promote her, I don't know. To be honest, I don't really pay much attention to what Paul Mason says on most things. What I would probably say is that if you are going to come out with comments, whether you think they're quietly in a letter to a diocese, whether you're Roman Catholic or Church of England or whatever, I think that isn't going to get into the public domain in a wider role as an MP pursuing higher station within the party, then you're kidding yourself. And Rebecca Long Bailey or her defenders can't say that her position on X is Y when it's clearly X. And if she has written, as I believe she has, saying she has misgivings about current legislation and that should be curtailed, which I believe she has, then you can't complain that the words that she has used have been used back. And if people have a problem with that, well, that's the Rebecca Long Bailey camp to deal with.
The comment he made was that he didn't want abortion legislation to be controlled from the Vatican. So, you know, quite anti-Catholic in its nature.
Paul's famous for making friends.
Um, Moving just again briefly back to anti-Semitism, I wondered what sort of anti-Semitism have you personally witnessed in the Labour Party?
Well, fortunately, when the last Labour Party meeting I officially attended at local levels in 2016, when going slightly off topic, since when I was an MP, I was addressing a GC in relation to an individual member who had threatened to assault me, and members there defended that member over me. So I said, well, see you later. You won't see me anymore. I wasn't prepared to sit in a room with people who were quite happy to see me assaulted. So that was that's the culture that was allowed to prevail under the leadership. So it is absolutely no surprise that all sorts of nastiness suddenly started getting embroiled in meetings at local Labour Party meetings as well as national or regional Labour Party meetings. Most of the anti-Semitism that I had seen was online, including one a bit by one of my own members who I shocked to the party again back in 2016. He was actually covered in the Sunday Times. He had a picture of the Statue of Liberty with a sort of alien creature on its face with a Star of David on it, and he thought this was acceptable. I didn't, and I said this is anti-Semitism, and I would appreciate the party to investigate him because I think this is anti-Semitic, and they duly did, and he resigned before he was kicked out. So I've seen it at the CLP level, but it's mainly online, and some of it is beyond the pale. It's been allowed to go on and on and on, and obviously with the Sunday Time revelations in terms of the party basically protecting these people to such an extent that where they were issuing death threats against my former colleagues, the party weren't even warning parliamentary colleagues that they were having death threats issued against them by these people. You know, it's bad. And I think the HRC report is going to be very damning. I think the whistleblowers, the party members of staff, who are trying to get this dealt with, whilst being frustrated by the likes of Jenny Formby, Karen Murphy, Seamus Mill, to name but a few names, Thomas Gardner, for example, they will be vindicated, I think, because this isn't going to go away. And the Jewish community are rightly appalled. And as a party, we've completely let them down. And it was, and you know, it took a lot of courage for people to come forward and do the right thing, but there was no other way. As a Labour member, if you're anti-racist, which I am, there is no other way but to call it out. There is no other way but to say this is happening and these people need to be dealt with. Every other excuse or reason given, which isn't they have to be dealt with, i.e. expelled and given to the police, is just not acceptable. It's as simple as that, really. It's not a complicated issue for me. And I think a lot of people are going to reap what they've sown in terms of either promoting this, allowing it, or facilitating it. And I look at the prime culprits, and I look at the entryism of the hard left as of 2015. People who were formerly in SWP, Left Unity, Respect, and other hard left organisations which have a history of this, entering our ranks and file and being allowed to. And all of them, pretty much some man and woman, voting for Jeremy Corbyn. And that will be his legacy. History. So I think when the HRC report comes out this year, I think it will be brutal, damning, necessary, but also highly useful for getting rid of some of the toxic elements which have been allowed to enter our party.
We're coming to the end of the podcast. It's been great to have you on, Tom. Thank you for being on. I'd just like to ask you one final question. It's a new year, it's a new decade. What New Year resolutions have you got or have?
New Year resolutions? Oh. Well, to stop having the occasional cigarette when I have too much to drink.
injury, and that's about it, really. Maybe sort of health centred ones. Probably to be more centred in and around my family a bit more. The last decade has been fairly eventful in terms of politics and things that I hadn't anticipated happening in my personal career. But yeah, I think maybe trying to mellow out, but you know, I wouldn't be Tom Blankensup unless, I wouldn't be me unless I was that sort of fairly cut and dry, vociferous type of person. So, but yeah, I'll try and mellow a bit.
Well, I think that is a New Year's resolution that a lot of people will perhaps be adhering to in the in the next few months. Well, thank you for coming on the podcast, Tom. It's been great speaking to you.
Cheers, Will. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. Don't forget that you can subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, or YouTube. You can follow us at Debated Podcast on Twitter. Like us, Debated Podcast on Facebook. And if you want to email us, either about appearing or making a comment or reaction to the episode you've heard, or any other episodes, then email us, thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.